Literally from the North Shore presents Dean Hovey's book Whistling Sousa in 14 episodes. This is episode 11.
I clenched her tight and I felt her tears soaking through my shirt. I'd done nothing wrong, but I still felt like a jerk for even having lunch with Sheila. I'm not going anywhere.
Whistling Sousa, Chapter 21, Tuesday. I woke again with tingling in my arm. When I opened my eye, I saw Jenny lying in the crook of my elbow, breathing softly. I tried to slip my arm from under her neck without waking her, but as my arm started to slide, she murmured and grabbed my wrist. "I've got to go to the Biffy," I whispered in her ear. She released my wrist, and I slipped out of bed. The clock said it was a little after 5, and I could hear the chirping birds outside the open window. As I walked to the bathroom, I heard the rattle of the woodpecker on Dolores's siding. I made a mental note to check out the selection of rubber snakes in town. I had a sudden revelation that I couldn't remember seeing a rubber snake in any of the stores. Maybe I'd need to check the internet. I spread shaving gel on my face and ran hot water over the razor. I looked at the once young face that stared back at me from the mirror as I scraped the whiskers off. When I'd gone into the Navy, I'd looked like a 12-year-old. Between the horrors I'd seen and the alcohol I'd abused, my boyish looks had changed. My mother said I finally looked like an adult. I'd lost my innocence in Iraq in many ways. When I got out of the shower, Jenny was making a pot of coffee. Her porcelain skin was especially translucent in the early morning light, and the thin T-shirt she wore was backlit by the windows and silhouetted her slim figure. The bruises on her arm and hip were highlighted. "What are you staring at?" she asked, as she handed me coffee in a cup with a logo from a farm supply store that went out of business shortly after the Shopko opened. "I'm just admiring your personal assets. I'd think that you'd seen enough of them last night to last you for at least a day," she replied as she poured herself coffee in a cup with a yellow smiley face, the mate to the one I kept in my office. "You think like a girl, not a guy." She leaned against the counter and blew on the steaming coffee. "What are your plans for today?" "I thought I'd try to find a rubber snake." She shuddered, the goosebumps rising on her arms. "I'd forgotten about the woodpecker problem. Where are you going to find a rubber snake?" "I suppose my best bet would be a novelty shop." "Wow, what a brilliant idea. I saw 5 of those downtown last week," she said with a smirk. I thought an internet search might point me somewhere. In the meanwhile, Shopko might be worth a look. I put 2 slices of bread into the toaster and then savored the aroma of the freshly opened peanut butter, which I thought was second only to the aroma of a fresh can of coffee. When I set the jar on the table, I saw Jenny staring at me with a strange look on her face. "What?" I asked. "I'm not sure you love me as much as you do that jar of peanut butter. You should have seen the expression on your face when you sniffed it." "You and peanut butter are in separate categories. I love both of you, but in different ways." "Do me a favor. If Sheila invites you to lunch, please decline the invitation." A smart aleck retort died on my lips when I looked at Jenny's face and saw how serious she was. "Agreed." I wandered the Shopko aisles in search of the rubber snake and came up empty. The greeter was genuinely sorry. In fact, she was so sorry that she pulled out her cell phone and called her hairdresser, who polled the ladies in the shop and told me to try the Sawtooth Mountain Trading Post. At the trading post, a perky strawberry blonde clerk with Claire embossed on her name tag smiled and listened politely when I explained the whole story about the woodpecker and the need to humanely scare it away. Once she was sure I was through with the story, she led me to an aisle with a few toys and showed me a rubber snake in the back of a bin.
It bore no resemblance to anything indigenous to the region, but woodpeckers are migratory, and I hoped he might not be too discerning. "I think it's been here since I started," she said, handing it to me. I looked at the green sponge rubber with painted brown stripes. "I don't suppose you'll reorder these?" I asked. Claire smiled and led me to the front counter. "I'll tell you what. If it actually keeps the woodpecker away, you let me know, and I'll order some and advertise them as woodpecker repellents." She rang it up, and I paid the entire 87 cents, including tax, with change from my pocket. Dolores watched me pull a ladder out of her garage and insisted she hold it with one hand, her cane in the other, as I climbed to the peak where I installed the snake with a cordless drill and a screw. When I climbed down, Dolores looked distressed. "What's wrong?" I asked as I folded the ladder. "I'm not convinced the snake will scare the woodpecker away. If this doesn't work, will you shoot the bird?" I hesitated, considering the potential conversation we'd have if I tried to explain the Federal Migratory Birds Act and the illegality of shooting songbirds, especially woodpeckers. Instead, I just replied, "Sure." "After you put the ladder away," Dolores said, "wash your hands and I'll feed you lunch. I made a tuna salad." I balked, but before I had time to decline, Dolores was back to her porch, marching toward her kitchen. I returned the ladder to her garage and hung it from dusty hooks on the wall. I looked around and noted that everything was neatly arranged, from wrenches hanging in order of size on a pegboard to wood boxes carefully labeled in neat block letters that identified the power tool they contained. Everything had a patina of dust that probably dated back to the death of Dolores's husband. I opened a box marked electric drill and saw a shiny metal drill with the electric cord carefully wound around the drill body and held in place by a cracked red rubber band. I touched the rubber band and it disintegrated, as did a portion of the insulation on the electrical cord, exposing the copper wire. I replaced the cover on the box, wondering if I should mention the deterioration of the tools to Dolores, then thought it better that she assumed her husband's workshop was in the same pristine condition he'd left it in several decades ago. I returned to my house and washed my hands in my own bathroom sink. I changed into a clean T-shirt and was knocking on Dolores's back door within 15 minutes. Lunch was carefully laid on the table when I entered the dining room. At a table that would seat a dozen, she'd set two places with flowered china plates, sterling silverware, linen napkins rolled inside silver napkin rings, and iced tea in crystal goblets. On each plate was a cabbage leaf topped with a scoop of tuna salad. The centerpiece was a dainty cut-glass vase with the rose I'd given her, flanked on one side by a silver sugar and creamer set, and on the other by china salt and pepper shakers that matched the place settings. I carefully held the chair for Dolores. After she was seated, I took my place, slid off the napkin ring, and shook open the napkin. I felt terribly underdressed in my gray Minnesota Twins T-shirt and blue jeans. "Peter, I'm very pleased you came for lunch. I rarely get to entertain these days." I looked at the tiny scoop of salad on my plate and quickly considered what I'd eat to finish filling my stomach when I returned to my house. I picked up the iced tea and took a sip, then started coughing. "Oh, dear," Dolores said, starting to rise from her chair. I waved to keep her seated and covered my mouth with the napkin as I caught my breath. I was unprepared for the liquor on the rocks in my goblet. "I suppose I should have warned you," she said, "but I saw the bottle of Jack Daniels by your counter, and I thought you'd enjoy a shot of booze." "I do enjoy it," I replied. It looked like iced tea, and it caught me by surprise. I took another sip to demonstrate my acceptance. Joe and I never drank much other than sherry, but he kept a bottle or two around for entertaining. The bottle is on the sideboard. I think it's something French.
It's been open a long time. I hope it hasn't gone bad. The label was French, and from what I could tell, it was very old cognac. Although it was smooth, I felt it was being wasted on me. I sampled the tuna, expecting the usual Minnesota recipe with canned tuna, mayonnaise, and maybe a touch of onion and celery. The tuna was suspiciously mild. I quickly realized that Dolores had switched sweetened sour cream for the mayo. There was a crunch, but it wasn't onion or celery. Once again, Dolores had either misread the recipe or had played fast and loose with the substitution of ingredients. Your tuna salad is an unusual recipe. I usually make it with mayonnaise or a spin blend. I've never had one made with sweetened sour cream before, I said. Oh dear, I hope you don't mind. The salad dressing was separated, so I opened some cream cheese, but it was too thick. I had to thin it with evaporated milk. She hesitated and added, Did I tell you it was tuna salad? I didn't have any tuna, so I used a can of chicken. I took another bite, and I could taste the caramelized evaporated milk. What are the crunchy bits? I asked. I found a can of water chestnuts in the back of the cupboard, she replied, setting my mind somewhat at ease. It was behind a can of mandarin oranges that had leaked. I had to pry it loose with a screwdriver. Uh-oh, I thought. If the water chestnuts were behind the mandarin oranges, they were probably older, and the oranges were old enough to eat through the can with the syrup gluing the can to the shelf. I took a healthy swallow of my cognac, hoping it would counteract the metals that had leached out of the cans and into the food. I probably wouldn't need my multivitamin with minerals. I put another bite of salad on the fork, relieved that the portion she'd served me was small. The woman who brought the rose, Dolores said between bites, I remember her because she was always dressed like a tramp. You shouldn't have anything to do with her. She has a reputation. I smiled at Dolores's polite choice of words. What type of reputation does she have? I asked, playing dumb. She has the kind of reputation that keeps her from getting invitations to the homes of nice people, Dolores said with obvious discomfort. It appears she has plenty of social engagements, I replied. Peter, you're missing my point. That woman is a social pariah. It would serve you well to not see her socially. Your blonde friend Jenny is very nice, although she has a bit of a reputation herself. Dolores paused and let out a sigh. I suppose it's more acceptable to have a child out of wedlock these days. I nodded, but said nothing. That bassoon player, she was the one who was poisoned at the county fair. I heard that someone put poison elderberry wine in those little pill bottles that she drinks out of during the concerts. Dolores paused, then added, You probably don't know this, but there are two types of elderberries that look very much alike. One is edible and the other is poisonous. Most people can't tell the difference, so they avoid them entirely. The Boyle family could tell the difference and would pick berries and make wine that they gave away to their friends. You never wanted to be one of their enemies because it was said that they also made wine from the poison berries, too. I don't think anyone named Boyle is in the band, I said, between tiny bites of salad. It doesn't matter anymore. The Boyles had a big Catholic family, and they've all intermarried with other families, so it's not safe to drink elderberry wine that anyone gives you anymore. You just have to assume you are getting it from one of the Boyle descendants, and you'd better hope they like you. It's not like the Currans. They were Protestants and only had ABC sex, so they hardly had any children or grandchildren. I'm not familiar with ABC sex, I said, taking a sip of cognac, and having a hard time believing I was having this conversation with my elderly neighbor. Dolores looked surprised. Everyone knows what ABC sex is. Anniversaries, birthdays, and Christmas. Women hardly ever got pregnant on that regimen, although that seemed to be a pretty regular schedule for some couples, especially shy Protestants in the days before the pill.
Why would that be more of an issue for shy Protestants?
Well, if you didn't want to get your wife pregnant, you had to buy condoms at the local pharmacy. If you were shy, you couldn't buy them in town, so you had to go all the way to Duluth or Silver Bay to buy them from a druggist who didn't know you. Unless you had a few spare dollars to stock up on a few of them, you didn't have sex very often. I couldn't hold my laughter any more, and I snorted a swallow of cognac up my nose. The cognac burned and my eyes watered. Dolores cracked a smile that highlighted the crow's feet at the corner of her eyes and gave me a glimpse of the beauty she'd once been. I suppose it sounds funny now, but times were different when you were in polite society, she explained. The miners moved to the Iron Range towns in droves, most leaving their wives and children behind in their home country. They brought them over after they'd earned enough to buy a house and a couple of acres. If you drive through Bawabic and those old mining towns, on every corner you'll see a building that was once a bar with an upstairs apartment rented out by the half hour. There were a lot of lonely men roaming those streets, and a nice girl wasn't seen outside her house after dark. Dolores looked at the rose and then back at me. If we were back in the old mining days, I suspect Sheila would be entertaining men in the apartment over one of those old bars. Times have changed and the business has changed, but I think Sheila's making a living bouncing her bottom on a mattress. There are a lot of women in this town who hear the same gossip that I hear, and some of them aren't too pleased about the loans their husbands got from Sheila. I think there's a lot of gossip flying around the hair salon, and not all of it is true, I said, picking at my salad. That's the wonder of gossip, Peter. It doesn't have to be true for people to believe it, and some of the people who believe it are Boyle descendants or other folks who know how to use a gun. Dolores suddenly had my full attention. Are you hearing threats against Sheila? I'm just saying, if I were you, I wouldn't stand in front of Sheila during the concert. Who's telling you this? I'm not sure I exactly recall that I heard anyone make a specific threat, but the ladies at Bingo all seem to agree that if Sheila shows up, none of the musicians will be sitting anywhere near her at the concert. Dolores slid her chair back and rocked her body a couple of times before gaining enough momentum to push herself to a stooped, standing position. I jumped from my chair and went to assist her, but she waved me away. All this talk about Sheila seems to have cost you your appetite, she said, looking at the half-scoop of faux tuna salad on my plate. She gathered her plate and utensils before allowing me to finish clearing the table and carrying the plates to the kitchen. You're doing a pretty respectable rendition of the Stars and Stripes Forever piccolo duet. I gave it a few tries, and there are still a lot of squeaks and squawks that don't belong there. You'll do well at the concert. As I scraped the plates into her garbage disposal, I again explained I wasn't going to add any part to myself in the concert. Like I said, I think it's hardly fair for me to step in and play the piccolo in my second concert with the band. Dolores was tapping her cane on the floor, and it caught my attention. Her eyes were narrow and her lips were tight. As you recall, Abigail Finch knocked on my door last week. Do you know who she is? She asked in a stern voice I'd never heard before. I don't think we've met, I said. Abby is in the 7th grade and she plays flute and piccolo in the school band. She also plays in the city band. I ran the mass of faces I'd met at the county fair through my mind. I suddenly remembered a diminutive girl with mousy brown hair and a face speckled with acne. She had been tucked in among the flutists as if they were protecting her. I remember her now. She paused for a second. I told her a piccolo player lived next door, and I promised her you'd be playing alongside her. That's why I gave you the piccolo. But you didn't know I'd even played a flute before, I protested. You can play any instrument you touch.
I'll be in the audience, and I expect you to play the duet flawlessly. Don't let me or that little girl down." With that, she turned and left me standing in the kitchen holding a china plate, dripping chicken salad into the sink. When I got home, I took a deep breath and started looking for the piccolo case. It was tiny and easy to misplace. Once I found it, I played the Stars and Stripes Forever piccolo solo until my fingers cramped. Hours later, I heard Jenny open the door just as I played the trill that ends the solo. "You'll never guess what Dolores did to me," I said as I gently set the piccolo on the piano. "You said you were going to find a rubber snake and hang it from her eaves. That's nothing compared to her other project." My resolve weakened by the cognac during lunch, I walked into the kitchen and took down two jelly jars that served as my juice glasses. I poured two fingers of Jack Daniels into each and handed one to Jenny. "I don't like whiskey very much," she said, sniffing the glass tentatively. "That's okay. Just hold it for me until I finish this one." I threw back the entire shot and set the glass on the worn Formica tabletop. When I reached for the other glass, Jenny pulled it back. "Not so fast. Will I need this after you tell me about Dolores's mission?" I eyed the glass, trying to gather polite words while holding back my frustration. "There's a seventh grader in the city band who plays piccolo. She asked Dolores to come back and play the Stars and Stripes Forever piccolo solo with her because she's too shy to play it alone. Dolores explained that her hands were too crippled. Abby said she wouldn't play alone, so Dolores told her I would play the solo with her." Jenny continued to hold the whiskey out of my reach. "So let me get this straight. Dolores volunteered you to play the piccolo solo with Abby Finch?" "You know Abby Finch?" "Sure, she lives down the street, and Jeremy has a crush on her, although I'm not supposed to know that." "How long have you been playing piccolo?" Jenny asked.
2 days, three if you count today." Jenny took a long swig of the Jack Daniels and started to cough.
"Wow, that's strong!"
"Why'd you drink it?" I asked.
"You have to be sober to practice."
Whistling Sousa, Chapter 22, Wednesday. Len was smoking his pipe under the portico when I arrived at work. As I approached, he tapped the embers out of the pipe bowl into the ashtray on top of the wastebasket. He looked up as I stepped onto the sidewalk and shook his head. "Looks like you had a couple of rounds of Jack Daniels last night." I waved him into the entryway, and we walked through the atrium into the dining room. I drew two cups of coffee from the urn, and we sat at a table near the kitchen amidst the clatter of cooking noises, mingled with laughter and chatter. The dining room was empty except for Barbie, who was arranging place settings and flowers on the tables near the windows.
"Do you know any more about what happened to Sheila?" Len asked.
"I know she's taking the brunt of the local gossip mill, and it sounds like every woman in town suspects she's betting their husbands to prop up her loan portfolio at the bank. I had lunch with her, and I think she spends a lot of time working out and meeting people at the gym who later turn into business for the bank." I took a sip of coffee and asked, "How about you?"
"I get the vibe that she dresses rather flashily," Len replied. "All the men think she's hot, and all the women think she's a whore. I think she's like one of the Hollywood starlets who's trying very hard to retain her face and figure so she looks like she used to."
"My neighbor Dolores invited me over for lunch," I said. "She made some interesting comments about women poisoning people and men mad enough to use guns."
"Guns? I don't like the sound of that. Who's got guns?" a voice asked behind me. I turned, and Angie Lafont, the head cook, was checking the coffee in the urn. Angie was pretty, in a goth sort of way, with her jet-black hair, tattoos, and piercings.
"I think everyone in the county has a hunting gun of some kind," Len answered casually. The police chief and Whistling Pines head investigator don't talk about hunting guns over coffee, Angie said. I'm guessing someone either got shot or is going to get shot. The kitchen door marked exit swung open, and Miriam pushed through with a platter of frosted cinnamon rolls. Their aroma filled the space, as did Miriam's personality. We made a batch of irregular pieces we won't feed to the residents. Help yourselves while they're warm, she said, offering the tray to us. Peter and the cop were just talking about people with guns, Angie said to Miriam. I've got a shotgun in the barn, Miriam offered. We have raccoons or skunks that show up in the barnyard now and again. No, Barbie wandered over and joined the conversation. They're talking about a gun to shoot somebody. I'm personally very much against guns, and I think the chief should confiscate the guns from anyone he suspects is going to shoot someone. Len was handling the whole discussion in stride and smiling. I was feeling the after effects of the cognac, Jack Daniels, and a short night of sleep due to too much piccolo practice. Brian Johnson walked in and handed me sheet music. Do you know how much beer a tuba holds? I shook my head. 8.5 gallons plus what's in the tuba player, he said with a smile. He then pointed to the music in my hand. I know you have the conductor's layout of Stars and Stripes Forever, but after I heard you were doing a piccolo duet with Abby Finch, I thought you might want to have the piccolo part separately. Who would put beer into a tuba? Angie asked. Sometimes I just get curious when I'm drinking, Brian replied. No one can drink 8.5 gallons of beer, Angie said. Who drinks alone? Brian asked with a shrug. You can play piccolo? Miriam asked me. It's an amazing coincidence, replied Brian. Abby Finch was the only piccolo player, and she's only a 7th grader, and so shy she wouldn't play the solo unless we found another piccolo player. Luckily, she found out that Peter can play piccolo, too. Miriam read right through me and shook her head. My, oh my, he's such a talented boy. He plays guitar and piano around here, and he's kept the piccolo in hiding. How long have you played piccolo, Peter? I've played flute for years, and picking up the piccolo was easy, I lied. Wendy appeared with her crossword puzzle and a pencil. Peter's playing piccolo? Well, that explains a lot. Everyone was suddenly silent as they turned to her. Like what? Len asked. It looks like he's got a piccolo in his pocket every time he sees Jenny. Everyone groaned, and I could feel the red creeping up my neck. She wandered off to a corner table and started penciling answers into the puzzle. Did you know that a pinhole can ruin a trumpet, but a tuba can play on with a bullet hole in it? Brian asked. What's the punchline? Angie asked. There's no punchline. It's just an observation. You guys were talking about guns and people being shot, and I thought that was an interesting piece of trivia. If you don't appreciate my trivia, I'll leave. See you at the concert tomorrow, Peter. Hey, Wendy yelled from the back corner of the room. Who's going to get shot? I might come to the band concert if someone's going to be shot.
The past 2 weeks' episodes of this program can be listened to from the ktwh.org website. Simply click on Literally from the North Shore from the program's drop-down menu found at the top of the homepage to listen to the archived shows.